side as glowing fires pushed back the darkness, the men like roaming shadows as they circled the herd. She did not fully comprehend the danger involved and was unaware of how quickly disaster could strike. But the sight and sound of it thrilled her because this was what she wanted to be a part of. Here things were happening, things beyond human control. And there was no house to take refuge in for protection, no doors to lock or windows to close. It was them against nature, winner take all. And the reality of it both frightened and enchanted her. She was beginning to respect Tobias and Emma and Zek, even more for having survived a lifetime of this, facing it again and again without trepidation, then coming back for more. When they reached the edge of the salt marsh, they were met by four armed riders who charged the lead steer, turning the herd away from the basin and toward the river. Tobias and Zek rode forward as Frog and Skillet popped their whips, regaining control of the herd and holding them in a circle. Tobias noticed cows scattered across the marsh as he rode to the line of men. He stopped directly in front of them and said, "What the hell you mean turning my herd like that? You could have caused a stampede." One man moved his horse forward and said, "You can't come in here. You'll have to go somewhere else." "How come?" Tobias asked. "We've been here every time we wanted to and nobody stopped us. Who says we can't come in now?" "This says," the man answered, waving a Winchester. "We got here first. Unless you want to risk getting your ass shot off, you move on away from here. I got 6 more men down there, all armed." "You ain't got the right," Tobias said angrily. "This place belongs to us as much as it does to you. And my cows needs the salt. We're coming in." 4 levers pumped as 4 Winchesters were pointed at Tobias and Zek. Tobias looked at the barrels and said, "This ain't going to do nobody any good. I got more riders and guns, too. There's grass enough for everybody."
"I say there ain't. The first cow you move in here gets shot, and every one that follows gets shot, and every drover, too. You just better back off, mister, and think about it."
Tobias wheeled the horse without further comment and rode back to the buckboard, popping his whip 2 times as a signal for Frog and Skillet to come in. Emma immediately noticed his stern expression and said, "What's happening, Tobias? Who are those men?"
"They're trying to turn us away."
"We got as much right to be here as anybody, Papa," Zek said. "We ought to start us a war."
"You don't know what a war is," Tobias responded. "If I have to, I will, but it ain't a pleasant thing to see. We'll talk first."
As soon as Frog and Skillet rode in, Tobias said, "Only way we're going to get in down there is to shoot our way in. What does everybody say we do?"
"How many men they got?"
Frog asked.
"There's 4 over there, and they claim to have 6 more."
"Well, there's 4 of us," Frog said. "And if the women shoot from up here, that cuts down the odds some. I say we have at it."
"What about you, Skillet?"
"I don't know, Mr. Tobias. Me, I don't mind going after them, but I sure don't want Pearly May and the boys getting shot off. How come just us men can't do it?"
"We can. We'll leave the women out of it. First thing we'll do is stampede the herd right at them. Then we'll come in behind the cows and shoot everything we see on a horse."
"No, Tobias,"
Emma exclaimed loudly.
"This has gone far enough. It's not worth it. We can go somewhere else."
"If we back down now, Emma, it'll happen again and again. Someday the range is going to get crowded. We've just been lucky so far. We're going to have to fight for what belongs to us."
"Belongs to us?" Emma questioned. "We don't own this marsh, Tobias. If you got here first, would you do the same thing those men are doing?"
Tobias didn't know exactly how to answer, never having faced such a situation.
"Well, I don't know. But at least we ought to share."
"I'm not saying we shouldn't," Emma said. "But those men don't want to. And all the cows in the world aren't worth one of us getting killed. If somebody has to die for that grass down there, Tobias, which one of us do you say it is? Which one? Is it me? Or Zek? Or Skillet? Who? If you have the right to choose, which one of us do you want to see killed?"
"Oh, Emma, I don't want nobody killed,"
Tobias said meekly. "You know that. I don't have the right to say somebody has to die, and I wouldn't say it even if I did have the right."
"That's right, Tobias. You don't have the right. So stop this foolishness and move the herd across the river and away from here. I don't want to hear any more of it unless you say I'm the first to die. Do you hear me, Tobias?"
"Yes, Emma. I hear. And I'm sorry to have riled you up so. Sometimes us men are like frogs. We jump before we think and land right in a gator's mouth.
Then he turned to the men and said, "What the hell are you staring at? You heard Emma. Get them cows moving toward the river."
Frog said, "If that's what you want, Mr. McCarvey. But I hope it comes a pure flood and them sons of bitches gets ate up by skeeters."
Emma breathed a sigh of relief as the men rode away. She said to Glenda, "That was close. And I couldn't have blamed them too much if they had charged in. There's grass enough to share. But some folks just don't want it that way."
"I'm learning," Glenda said. "I couldn't have pulled that off like you did, no matter what. I would probably have pleaded with them, but I'm learning."
"You best. Things like this are going to happen more and more as time passes. It frightens me to think of it. If the men had been here alone, somebody would be dead by now. Maybe all of them."
Zek and Skillet rode ahead, buying cows and bringing them into the herd, and when they reached the Caloosahatchee, the total was just over 2,000. Tobias seemed disinterested as the sacks of gold coins were placed on the table. Zek took them out to the buckboard alone and gave Frog and Skillet their share. He told his mother and Glenda to take what they needed to buy supplies for the return trip and for whatever else they wanted. When the two women came from the store, both were dressed in jeans, denim shirts and boots, and Glenda had on a black felt hat. Her hair was tied in a ponytail that hung down her back. Frog was the first to notice, and he said loudly, "Ooh-wee, just look at that! Miss Emma and Miss Glenda got on breeches!" Glenda turned around and around, showing herself, and Zek said, "What's all this? You two look like drovers."
"It's silly for us to wear dresses on a drive," Glenda said. "This is much better, and Emma agrees. We've got as much right to wear breeches as any of you."
"You have for a fact," Frog said, giggling, "and I think I'll just go on in there and buy myself a dress. What color you think would look best on me, Zek?"
"Red. And you ought to get yourself some pink bloomers, too. I'll help you put them on."
"Next one who makes a crack like that has dipped his last time in the cooking pot," Emma snapped.
"I think you look just fine, Miss Emma," Frog said quickly. "You ought to have bought them things a long time ago. Now you and Miss Glenda can ride a horse without sitting side saddle."
Emma turned to Pearly May. "You want some breeches, too?"
"No, ma'am, I better not,"
she responded, glancing at Skillet.
"It'd take a pair big enough to stretch over a ox for me, more like a tent. I better not, Mrs. Emma."
Zek said, "If you don't mind, all of you go on back to the camp and the buckboard and leave me the wagon. I got something to haul. You can take Ishmael, Glenda."
"I'd like that," Glenda beamed. "It'll give me a chance to ride in my new outfit."
Emma frowned as Glenda mounted the horse, but she said nothing. The red ponytail swished from side to side as she tested Ishmael down the street and back. Then she trotted the horse ahead of the buckboard. Zek went into the store and purchased tools. Then he drove the wagon to a lumber yard on the north edge of town. When he arrived back at the camp, the wagon was stacked to capacity with lumber, its wheels groaning, and a load of cypress shingles was ordered for delivery the next morning. Tobias stared as the oxen struggled in, puffing, and then he said,
"What in thunder's all that for? You aim to pull that load slam across the prairie?"
"No, Papa," Zek answered, climbing down. "It's for here. I'm going to build a cabin. If everybody pitches in and helps, we could do it in a couple of days."
"How come you want a cabin in Punta Rasa?"
"Just some place to stay when we come over here, and we'll let folks know we own the land."
"I don't think nobody cares," Tobias said.
"But we'll do it if that's what you want. It don't make no difference if we start back a couple of days later, just so I get back pretty soon to see about my oranges."
Hammers pounded and saws pinged as the task took on the festive air of a barn raising. The women abandoned the cooking pot and supervised, telling the men to extend a wall here, put the stoop there, windows here, and the door over yonder. By late afternoon, the floor was down and all the framing up, and they went back into the town and ate the cafe completely out of fried chicken and fish. Glenda enjoyed all of it, thrilled to be a part of people doing things, already planning in her mind where the bed should go, the color of curtains, a rug here and a shelf there. That night after they had gone to bed, Glenda still reeled with excitement and was unable to sleep. She aroused Zek and said,
"Will you buy me a horse?"
"Huh?"
he responded sleepily. A horse, Zek. I want one of my own.
Sure. What kind you want, a green one or a blue one?
She shook his shoulder. Be serious.
You want a horse? You got a horse. Would you like a marsh tacky like Ishmael? A little horse would be better for you. It's like riding in a rocking chair.
I'd love a little horse. But I've never seen another like Ishmael. All the horses at Fort Drum are big like the ones all the other men here have.
The Indians have more like Ishmael down in the swamp where they live. Sometime this fall, when we don't have much to do, I'll take a trip and get one for you.
Will you really?
First chance I get.
She leaned over and kissed him. I love you, Zek.
Oh, my. He groaned, putting his arms around her. You do that again, I'm liable to come back with a whole passel of horses. Maybe we ought to talk about it some more.
Let's do. I'm not sleepy anyway. But I don't need a passel. Just one little horse would be fine.
The shingles arrived at mid-morning, and by late afternoon the cabin was completed, a day sooner than Zek anticipated. That night he and Glenda slept in it, and an hour after dawn the next morning the McIvey caravan reached the ferry landing, crossed the river, and headed east. They journeyed leisurely, stopping often in mid-afternoon so the men could hunt deer that would be roasted whole on sweet gum spits over beds of hickory coals. Glenda traded places with Tobias, riding the horse with Zek while Tobias drove the buckboard, Emma disapproving and cautioning Glenda to go easy, but retaining the secret. They were 5 days out of Punta Rasa, turning to the northeast toward the lower Kissimmee, when they entered an area of scrub pine and thick palmetto. Glenda and Zek were riding ahead, with Frog and Skillet at the rear behind the wagon. The first shot came from a thicket on the right, striking Glenda's horse in the shoulder, sending it tumbling forward instantly. She tried to jump from the saddle as the horse crashed down on top of her. Zek wheeled Ishmael just as a bullet exploded the horse's brain, peppering him with blood and bits of tissue. He, too, hit the ground beneath the horse. Tobias stared disbelievingly as Glenda and Zek struggled to break free. Then he shoved Emma from the buckboard and jumped on top of her, shielding her from a spray of splinters as bullets ripped into wood. The horse bolted forward, taking the buckboard past the dead horses and directly toward the line of fire. Pearly Mae jumped from the wagon and ran for a palmetto clump, dragging all three boys with her, screaming, "Oh my! Oh my!" Frog emptied his Winchester in less than 10 seconds, firing into bushes and palmetto, aiming in the direction of smoke puffs and fire belches. Then he jumped to the ground, struck the horse to make it move away, and started reloading. Skillet followed Pearly Mae, making sure she was safely hidden in the brush. Then he, too, fired the rifle as fast as empty cartridges spewed from the ejection chamber. Zek struggled and kicked, finally freeing himself from the mound of lifeless flesh. He pulled the rifle from the saddle holster and used Ishmael as a shield, lying flat and shooting over the horse, then glancing back and seeing Glenda still pinned. He crawled over the ground to her, untangled her foot from the stirrup, and pulled her into the palmetto. Tobias and Emma also crawled for cover, hopping quickly, Tobias cursing because his rifle was in the buckboard. Then he remembered the shotgun lying in the wagon bed. He dashed forward, grabbed it and a sack of shells, and retreated into the brush. The bewildered horse stopped the buckboard at the edge of a thick line of trees. Tobias watched as two men scrambled into the wagon bed and struggled with the trunk, sliding it toward the rear. He said to Emma, "It's the gold. Them bastards are trying to kill us for the gold. They must have followed us all the way from Punta Rasa." The buckboard was 50 yards away, and Tobias calculated in his mind how much the shots would spread in that distance. He put a shell in each barrel, aimed at the space between the two men, and pulled both triggers simultaneously. The boom overwhelmed all other sound, drowning the sharp pop of rifles. Both men screamed as they were knocked backward from the buckboard, peppered with buckshot, one jumping up and running blindly, blood gushing from both eyes. He ran no more when a bullet from Frog's Winchester smashed through his ribcage and blew parts of his heart out the other side. Tobias reloaded the shotgun, waiting for a sign, watching for a puff of smoke or fire to give him direction. He fired one barrel, aimed quickly to the right, and fired again, hearing more screams as bits of palmetto fronds and pine limbs exploded into instant sawdust. The barrel of Frog's rifle became too hot to touch as he loaded and fired again and again, covering the ground with empty shells. He was not even aware of Skillet beside him, also firing rapidly at any sign of life across the open space. None of them knew the precise moment the opposite firing stopped as they continued pouring lead into bushes and trees. Then, one by one, they lowered their rifles and listened, hearing no sound except their own heavy breathing. Tobias ventured out first, going to the wagon and squatting behind it. Then Zek walked to Ishmael and knelt beside him, his face ashen, shaking the body as if to awaken it. Frog jumped on his horse and charged across the open area, Tobias shouting, "No, Frog, no! Don't go in there yet!" Frog paid no heed as he galloped full speed into the woods and disappeared. Emma rushed to Glenda, having seen her go down with the horse, finding her lying in the bushes, clutching her stomach and moaning.
"Glenda, are you all right?"
Glenda's face twisted with pain as she said,
"It hurts, Emma. It hurts real bad. I think it's going to come out at me." "Oh, Lord," Emma exclaimed, touching Glenda's face, then shouting, "Pearly May, come quick. Bring cloth and water from the wagon."
Tobias and Skillet walked into the edge of the woods, finding tree trunks and bushes splattered with blood, one horse down with its stomach blown out. Skillet said,
"I knowed we was bound to have hit something, all that lead we put in here. There's some men out there somewhere show hurtin'. That cannon you got damn nigh blew down the trees." "I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of it," Tobias said. "What we gonna do with them two you blowed out of the buckboard? Leave him for the buzzards or bury him?"
"They'd probably make the poor buzzard sick. We'll bury him." They heard Emma's voice.
"Zek, come here."
Zek walked to her slowly, muttering,
"Damn them. Damn them."
Emma said,
"Get your tent and put it up here. Hurry."
"They killed Ishmael,"
Zek said absently, still shocked.
"Forget the horse," Emma snapped sharply. "Glenda's hurt. There's no time left. Move quickly."
"What's the matter with her?" Zek asked, brought back to reality by Emma's urgency. "Was she hurt when the horse fell on her?"
"Stop asking questions and move," Emma insisted. "Just do what I tell you. I'll explain later."
As soon as the tent was up, Emma and Pearly May moved Glenda inside. Zek hovered outside, hearing the moans, temporarily forgetting the downed horse, as concern for Glenda pushed all else from his mind. He paced back and forth until Emma finally emerged, carrying a small, cloth-bound bundle. She went behind the tent, and then returned empty-handed. Zek said,
"What's the matter, Mama? Tell me now, I want to know."
Emma's eyes filled with tears as she said,
"She's had a miscarriage, Zek."
"A miscarriage? What's that?"
"She was pregnant, and she's lost the baby. It was a little girl."
"Baby? Glenda was going to have a baby?"
Zek's face was first puzzled,
then contorted with anguish, as he realized what Emma was saying.
"I didn't know, Mama. Why didn't she tell me? I wouldn't have let her come if I'd known. She had no right to keep this from me."
"Now, don't you start that," Emma said harshly. "I don't want to hear a word of it. She told me, and I promised not to tell you, for the very reason you just said. She kept it a secret because she wanted to come along and be with you and with all of us. She loves you that much. Can't you understand this? I wish she had told me. She's the bravest girl I've ever known, and you ought to be proud of her. Now you go on in there, and don't you say one damned word to make her feel worse than she feels now. Do you understand me, Zek? This is not her fault. She didn't shoot that horse out from under herself."
"I understand now, Mama. It's just hard for me to take all at once."
Glenda was lying on a blanket, her face white and sweating, her blue eyes not sparkling as usual. She looked up when Zek entered. And then she pushed herself up and cried,
"I'm so sorry, Zek. I'm so sorry. I would have told you as soon as we got back to the hammock."
Zek dropped down and put his arms around her, holding her close. He said gently,
"It's all right, Glenda. I understand. We'll make another baby as soon as you're well enough. I'm just glad you're fine. Oh, Zek, I just wanted to be with you. I'm so sorry."
He brushed warm tears from her cheeks, feeling the dampness of her hair. Then he pushed her back to the blanket and said,
"Just rest now, Glenda. Everything will be fine. We'll give the baby a proper burial. There'll be others." When he came outside, he said to Emma, "Where'd you put the baby?"
"Behind the tent."
"I'll get a shovel." Emma put her arms around him and stopped him for a moment.
"Oh, Zack, I'm so sorry this happened to you and Glenda. Just don't blame her. It wasn't her fault."
His face was sober as he pulled away. "I'm not blaming Glenda anymore. And I know whose fault it is. It's those bastards out there somewhere. They won't stop till they kill us all. Unless I kill them first, and I will."
"Don't say that, Zack. And don't feel that way. The Lord will punish them. The Lord..."
He turned and walked away before she could finish, moving rapidly to the wagon, snatching up a shovel and banging it against one wheel, beating the spokes again and again until finally the startled oxen bolted forward and ran across the clearing. Zack then saw Frog come from the woods and stop beside Tobias and Skillet. A man trailed the horse, a rope around his neck, his hands tied behind him. He was tall and gaunt, his clothes filthy, a matted black beard covering his face. Frog said,
"This must be the one whose horse was shot. I found him hiding in a bush. He sure is a pretty sight for a bushwhacking killer, ain't he?"
Zack went to them as Frog dismounted. Tobias said, "Now that you got him, I don't rightly know what to do with him. There ain't no law out here to turn him over to."
"That's for sure," Frog said. "I ought to have just shot him out there in the woods."
Zack dropped the shovel and sprang cat-like onto the horse, startling the others because they were not aware of his presence. He grabbed the rope attached to the saddle and kicked the horse's flanks, bounding away into the woods, dragging the man through the brush. He heard his father shout, "Zack, what the hell you doing? Come back here!" He raced full gallop for 50 yards, feeling the rope jerk as the body bounced off the base of trees. Then he stopped and threw the rope over a hickory limb. There was no struggle or cry for mercy as the horse moved forward again, snatching the body upward, dangling it just beneath the limb. Zack was not aware of where he was until he felt Skillet pull him from the saddle and back the horse, lowering the lifeless body to the ground. He stared blankly as Frog said,
"You sure settled that in a hurry, Zack. All we've got to do now is plant him."
Tobias said nothing as he looked into Zack's glazed eyes, knowing that any comment now would be useless and wasted. He surmised that something must have happened other than Ishmael's death to make Zack take such a drastic action. He said to Skillet, "Bring him on back to the others and we'll bury him in one grave." Then he turned and ran through the woods toward the place where he saw Emma rush to Glenda. One grave was only 2 feet long, the other huge. Zack insisted they bury Ishmael, too. Crosses made of hickory limbs were at the head of each mound. All of the men were soaked with sweat from digging, their shirts dust-covered and clinging to their bodies. Zack held Glenda up, his arm tightly around her, bringing her from the tent, although Emma advised against it. Tobias turned to Zack and said, "You want me to say words, or you want to do it yourself?"
"I'll do it myself. It's my baby."
Zack took off the black felt hat and pressed it to his chest. And the others did likewise. He said,
"Lord, bless this little girl, and see to it the wolves don't dig her up. Make her to be a fine woman, like Mama and Glenda. And Lord, forgive me for what I've done, but the bastard deserved it. Amen."
Then he led Glenda back to the tent and went inside with her. At Emma's insistence, they camped for 2 more days, letting Glenda rest and regain strength. Zack roamed the woods, finding wildflowers and putting them on the grave each day. On the 3rd morning, they put Glenda into the covered wagon, Emma riding with her and Zack driving. Tobias rode with Skillet and his family on the buckboard. Zack glanced at the graves one final time. Then he popped his whip and moved the oxen forward.
Chapter 27. September passed into October as the men made trip after trip into Fort Pierce,
purchasing and stockpiling barrels to be used when the oranges matured later that year. February's blossoms turned into green globes that grew larger each week and would eventually inundate the trees with balls of gold. Glenda recovered fully, and the nightmare was gradually overshadowed by the everyday routine of living, not forgotten, but looked upon as one more tragedy endured. It was the end of October when Zek set out alone for the cypress swamp to purchase a marsh tacky for Glenda and another to replace Ishmael. This would be no leisurely trip, camping often and shooting game along the way. His saddlebag contained smoked beef and biscuits, and he cantered the horse more than he walked it. He was expected back as soon as possible to help with the orange harvest. As he rounded the eastern shore of Okeechobee and turned southwest, something came back to him that had been pushed far back in his memory. Tawanda. During those years Glenda remained in school in Jacksonville, and he knew he would eventually marry her, he gradually forgot Tawanda, thinking he would never see her again, or even visit the Indian village. He did not think of Tawanda now with the passion and yearnings that once tormented him. He wondered if she were still there, if she had married and had children. But he could no longer smell the smoke and crushed pine needles, or feel the warmth of her body or the softness of her hair. She was only a vague shadow from the past, and he was not sure he could even recognize her. He skirted the eastern edge of the custard apple forest and entered the swamp, searching for something familiar, some landmark that would jar his memory and point the way. But he found none. It had been too long, and now all trees looked the same, all ponds and sloughs the same, all trails the same. For 2 days he wandered, becoming more discouraged as he zigzagged from east to west and moved southward, penetrating deeper into a forest that seemed even more awesome than he remembered, sometimes plodding the horse through shallow coverings of water that lasted for miles before finding firm ground. He was considering abandoning the quest when he was confronted by an Indian armed with a rifle. Zek was startled when the man stepped from behind a palmetto directly in front of him, blocking the way. His eyes were hostile, and they both stared silently until Zek said, "I'm looking for the village of Keith Tiger. I've been there, but I'm lost now. Can you give me directions?" The Indian made no answer, except to motion with the rifle for Zek to follow him. 1 hour later, they entered a clearing dotted with chickies. Other than 2 old women and the cooking chickie, the village seemed deserted. As Zek dismounted, his guide pointed with the rifle, but still did not speak. This puzzled Zek, for the reception his father received from the Seminoles had been so different from this, friendly and with genuine affection. He tied the horse to a bush and walked to the edge of the clearing, finding 2 old men sitting beneath one of the chickies. Again he searched his memory for recognition, but found none. Then he said, "I'm looking for Keith Tiger. I have business with him." One of the men said, "I am Keith Tiger. What is your business?" "You don't remember me, but my name is Zek McIvey, son of Tobias McIvey. I was here once with my father." The old man smiled, Zek's first sign of welcome, making him feel more at ease. "It is good to see you, Zek McIvey. And you are welcome. You have grown so much, I did not know you. When you were here before, you were a boy, and now you return as a man. How is Tobias?" "He's doing pretty good at times, but he still has spells of malaria. He's not as strong as he used to be." "None of us are as we grow older. It is a pity of time passing. But I worried about Tobias when he left here so sick. It is good to know he survived. What brings you on such a long journey to find me?"
"I want to buy horses," Zek responded, sitting in front of Keith Tiger. 2 marsh tackies, like the one you gave us a long time ago. I didn't know anywhere else to get them but from you."
"They are yours for the asking, but I will accept no pay. We still owe you for the cows. I will have the horses brought here in the morning. They are at a place deeper in the swamp. We do not keep our horses and cows here in the village, where they might be seen."
"Tomorrow's fine, but I'll be glad to pay."
"You have paid already for much more than 2 horses. Your father is a friend we will never forget. And do not be troubled by your reception here. No one knew who you were. And there has been much trouble lately between our people and some bad white men in the 10,000 Islands. It will be different when you are known as a MacIvy. Our people will come back into the village soon, and I will tell them. Are you hungry?
Yes, I am, Zek admitted. I was in a hurry to get here and didn't cook along the way.
Then you must eat now. Come with me, and I will get food for you.
Zek followed the old man to the cooking chikki, where he was ladled a large wooden bowl of turtle stew and given a chunk of kunti bread. He sat on the ground outside the hut and ate as Keith Tiger returned to the chikki. He thought of asking about Tawanda, but decided against it, thinking she no longer lived in the village and was elsewhere with a family of her own. It disappointed him that he would not see her, even briefly, or at least know what happened to her. After eating, he unsaddled the horse, and then returned to the chikki, finding Keith Tiger asleep. He didn't want to disturb the old man, so he went back to his horse, mounted, and rode bareback into the woods, following a trail to the south. He would like to see Pehe'oki again, but knew it was too far a journey for an afternoon. And even if there were time, he was unsure of the way. He walked the horse slowly, killing time, feeling uncomfortable alone in the village without even the old man to talk to. He wished the hours would pass quickly so he could take the horses and leave. The voice came from behind him as the trail turned to the left.
It is you, isn't it, Zek?
He stopped the horse immediately and looked back, seeing her standing there, the same brown skin and deep-set eyes, the flowing black hair, a still youthful body now mature. She said,
I watched you as you came into the village. Can I ride with you?
He reached down, took her hand, and pulled her up behind him.
Why didn't you come forward and speak? I thought you didn't live here anymore.
I was too surprised. I didn't think I would ever see you again. And there you were.
As the horse stepped forward, she put her arms around him and drew close, pressing against him, bringing back a flood of memories so vivid it seemed to Zek it happened only yesterday, that he never left the swamp at all. He put his right hand on her arm, feeling the firm flesh as his hand moved back and forth, his mind suddenly blocking out all things but her presence there with him on the horse, riding a trail he once rode with her when they were both too innocent to know what love can be. He did not know if he turned the horse or if it turned itself. They moved off the trail and stopped beneath a bald cypress surrounded by a ground covering of green moss. She slipped down first, and as he dismounted, she wilted to the ground, speaking to him with her eyes. There was no timidity this time, no hesitancy. He dropped down into the moss and took her in his arms, and it happened so quickly he had no time to cast doubts about what he was doing. There were no thoughts of Glenda or the marsh tackies or why he was there or anything but Tawanda. She put her face against his and said,
Why did you wait so long to come back? I watched the trail each week until I finally gave up.
I wanted to come back, but too many things happened with my family. I thought of you a lot.
I thought of you too, all the time at first, and then I tried to forget, but I couldn't. I'm glad you're here now. I've waited so long for you.
There's something I must tell you, Tawanda,
Zek said hesitantly.
I'm married now.
The words did not shock her or anger her.
She said, It doesn't matter. I would want to be with you anyway. Is she pretty?
Yes. Her name is Glenda. We were going to have a baby, but she got hurt in an ambush and lost it.
That is sad. You deserve many sons, and I'm sure there will be others. You have not told me why you're here.
To buy horses. I want marsh tackies, and I can't find them anywhere else. I have to start back in the morning and help Papa harvest his oranges.
We'll spend the night here together, she said with excitement. I'll go to the village and get food and blankets, and you can rest while I'm gone.
What will everyone think if we do this? Zek asked doubtfully.
I don't care what anyone thinks. I'm not promised to any man, because I choose not to be. And no one will come looking for us. I'll go now, and return soon.
Zek watched as she jumped up, put on the dress, and ran down the trail. He felt as if he were caught in a hurricane, sucking him backward in time, powerless to control what was happening, even if he wanted to. He was not the leader, but the follower, doing what she wanted him to do, and if she had resisted, he would have backed away. It happened because they wanted it to happen and made it happen, and no one would be hurt by it. Then he wondered why he was reasoning with himself, why he felt the necessity to explain it away to himself or to anyone. All he cared about at this moment was for her to come back and be with him. His other world seemed very far away. When they rode into the village together at dawn, Tawanda's face beamed with fulfillment. Her emotions so obvious, he knew that everyone would notice. But no protest was made, not even by her father or mother, as they watched Zek and Tawanda take food and go off alone. Zek was glad they accepted it, for he wanted no trouble with them or anyone in the village, no ill feelings among people who were his father's friends. And there apparently were none. The marsh tackies were waiting, and after a final farewell, he tied them behind his horse. He put a loaf of kunti bread Tawanda prepared for him into the saddlebag. Then he kissed her, undisturbed that others were watching them. Once mounted, he rode away quickly, not looking back, for fear he would return and stay longer.
With each mile he traveled, bringing him closer to the hammock and his real world, Zek felt pangs of guilt. He tried to push Tawanda from his mind and pretend it had not happened at all, but he knew it had. It was all too real to be make-believe. He thought that what he had done made him no different from a bull going from cow to cow, planting seed indiscriminately in all of them. Then he salved his conscience by reasoning it could not have been prevented under the circumstances, that it was a natural act between a man and a woman who cared for each other. What he had done with Tawanda belonged in the swamp and would remain there, and had nothing to do with his life with Glenda. These were two separate worlds, one real and one fantasy, and there was no reason for them to ever meet. He knew Glenda would never do the same when away from him, and this bothered him the most. Her love and commitment was total. Yet his was broken at the first opportunity. It was unfair to her, and he admitted it. But it happened only with Tawanda. He wasn't a bull, and he had not gone from cow to cow, only to the one other woman he had ever wanted. This made a difference. It was not something he had run away seeking, like a bull bursting through a fence to get at six cows, not caring which was which. And it would never happen again. His final rationalization was that Glenda deceived him once and once only about the baby. He would deceive her this one time only with Tawanda, equalizing things back to zero and also being the end of it. As he approached the hammock, he looked back at the marsh tackies, the purpose of his trip, trying to decide which he should keep for himself and which would be Glenda's. Keith Tiger had selected a stallion and a mare, telling him that marsh tackies were becoming rare and would someday soon die out and vanish forever, that if he wanted more, he should raise his own from this pair. He would take the stallion and give Glenda the mare, for the mare would be more loving and gentle. When the time came and the mare went into heat, they would mate the two and perpetuate the breed. He was sure Glenda would approve of his decision and be happy with the mare, for she would know how to handle a stallion, as well as he. Chapter 28, 1883. Solomon McIvey, was born March 12, 1883, in a flurry of activity as Emma and Pearlie May bounded about, shouting orders for more hot water and towels. The bewildered men stoking great fires under two cast-iron washpots, filling the clearing with smoke. Zek thought they had boiled enough water to scald and scrape a dozen hogs, and he wondered if his mother and Pearlie May were drowning Glenda and preparing the same fate for the baby. It was a breech delivery, and very difficult, and Zek winced with horror each time he heard screams coming from the house, making him vow he would never again inflict such pain on Glenda if this was what birthing was all about. He had seen calves born wrong, making it necessary to cut off the calf's head in order to pull the twisted body from its mother and save her life, and the thought of it turned his stomach sick. But after 6 hours of constant turmoil, Emma and her assistant extracted a healthy, wailing boy from Glenda. 2 days later they chose the name Solomon, because Zek had been reading the Bible and discovered that Solomon, son of David and king of Israel and Judah, was noted for his wisdom. Saul, as they would call him, would be a very wise man indeed, since he would be the first McIvey to have his own private tutor from birth. Glenda would give him knowledge beyond all things Zek and his father could ever know, and he would be the one to build a McIvey temple rather than a frontier house made of rough cypress long since turned black by exposure to the elements. When it came time in April to move the herd for grazing, Emma and Pearlie May both refused to go, telling the men to fend for themselves while they stayed behind to look after Glenda and the baby. Under protest, Skillet was elected cook by a vote of 3-1. Zek left the hammock reluctantly, fearing that in his brief absence the baby would grow up and not know him as the father. He was puffed with pride but would not hold the baby, convinced that such a small and delicate thing would surely break in his rough hands. He cautioned Glenda and his mother to be very careful with Saul, causing them to smile knowingly, and assure him they would do their best while he was gone. Tobias decided not to move the herd too far from the hammock and sent a rider back every 2 days to make sure the women were fine. They moved south, heading for the lower Kissimmee Valley, where the marsh and prairie grass should be plentiful. It was midweek of the second week when 6 riders came out of the southwest and approached Skillet on the right flank. One said briefly, "Who owns these cows?"
"Mr. McIvey," Skillet answered, pointing. "That's him over there, just behind the herd."
Zek noticed the riders and came over to see what they wanted. One said to Tobias, "Where are you taking this herd?"
"Nowhere in particular," Tobias responded. "Just grazing wherever they want to go. We do it every summer."
"Well, you can't go any further in this direction."
"How come?"
Tobias asked, thinking it was another situation like the one they encountered at the salt marsh.
"I don't see any more cows anywhere. This is private land, all the way from here down to Lake Okeechobee. You're trespassing right now."
"Private land? How come all of a sudden it's private land? It's always been open range."
"Not anymore. This is Diston land. Mr. Diston bought 4 million acres here."
"How many?"
Tobias questioned, baffled by the figure.
"You deef? I said 4 million. Bought it from the state for $1 million. Mr. Diston has done run all the squatters off, and he's got plans to drain all this land and develop it. He's already got dredges working. He don't want nobody driving cows in here, and that includes you."
"What if I want to drive a herd through here to Punta Rasa? What could I do if he closes the land?"
"I don't give a damn what you do. You can take them cows, slam around the south end of Okeechobee, you can go back north and find another way, or you can shove them up your butt, but you're not going through here."
"What if I do it anyway?"
Tobias shot back, his anger beginning to boil.
"I got 150 men working on this place, and all of them are armed. We'll shoot every cow that enters. Now, if you want to convert them cows to carcasses, you just go ahead and push them in the direction you're going. That's all I got to say."
With that, the men rode off 100 yards and stopped, forming a line facing the herd, rifles drawn.
"Damn them," Tobias cursed.
Then he said to Zek, "Go tell Frog and Skillet to turn him. We can't fight 150 men. We'll go back north and then cut to the west, toward the salt marsh, but ain't nobody got the right to close off the land."
"Papa, this is just the beginning," Zek said. Someday there won't be any open range left. Last time I was over at Fort Drum and talked to Mr. Turner, he said men are out everywhere now surveying land for new railroads, and the railroad companies are buying everything they can get. The lumber companies and turpentine men are doing it, too. Someday it's coming to an end, Papa, and there's nothing we can do about it.
You're wrong, Tobias responded. It ain't coming to an end, and it never will. But if this kind of crap keeps up, we'll just put in more orange trees and run less cows. Prices keep going up like they've been doing. We ought to be able to clear $1,000 an acre on oranges.
Maybe so, Papa. But if we stay in the cattle business, we're going to have to own the land and fence it, too.
Fence it? That's the best way I know to start a range war. I know what I'd do if I came to a fence. I'd cut it.
And maybe get yourself killed for doing it.
Whose side are you on? You sound more like a landlord than a cattleman.
I'm not talking sides, Papa. I'll always be with you, and you know it. What I'm talking is sense.
We'll see, Tobias said, dismissing the conversation. Go on now and help Frog and Skillet turn the cows. We'll find grass elsewhere. There just ain't no way we can face 150 men.
As Zek rode off, he thought about the deed lying in a drawer in his cabin. McIvy land that would never be closed to them. He must plan soon to convert more of the gold doubloons into land.
Chapter 29, 1888. The cattle drives were reduced to one every 2 years, and much of the grazing was done on McIvy land. More and more they encountered other herds on the prairies, landless men searching for open range and free grass. And often the sound of Winchesters could be heard firing point-blank at quarter-mile distances, warning intruders away. Had it not been for Emma, they would have already engaged in at least a half dozen all-out gun battles over grazing rights. Others were not so fortunate as range wars broke out everywhere. Tobias gradually increased his orange grove to 300 acres, and if they never owned another cow, the grove would provide a good living. But cows were in their blood, especially Zek's, and they refused to give it up. It was a way of life too deeply ingrained to discard easily. The days of driving herds across open land, where nothing could be seen but endless wilderness, were vanishing rapidly. But there was still profit in cows. Tobias wanted to fight for it, but Zek was formulating other plans. First, he would fence the McIvy land, which he had increased to 30,000 acres. Then he would look to the south for additional land. The last great manless frontier lay to the south of Lake Okeechobee. And it was there he felt his future destiny lay. Someday, he would explore this possibility. Skillet left the caravan as they returned from Punta Rasa, telling Tobias he had a chore to tend to in Kissimmee. Tobias wondered about this, remembering that Skillet's previous chore of finding himself a wife had taken several years. There were now 5 boys riding in the wagon with Pearly May, and their wailing had been the only sound of babies born in the McIvy hammock since Saul. Glenda had become pregnant 2 more, each one ending in a miscarriage, and Emma feared that complications caused by Saul's difficult birth might prevent Glenda from having another child. It was just before noon when Skillet came into the clearing, driving a wagon hitched to 2 oxen, his horse trailing behind. Tobias watched curiously as Skillet tied the oxen and came to the stoop. Then he said to him,
"Where'd you get that outfit?"
"In Kissimmee. They's good oxen, ain't they?"
"They look right fine, but we don't need another team, unless you plan to fill another wagon with babies. And you're getting kind of old for that."
"I just thought I wanted them," Skillet said, casting his eyes downward.
Tobias noticed that Skillet was not looking at him as he spoke, avoiding his eyes, and this puzzled him. He said,
"Are you feeling poorly, Skillet? You don't seem right to me."
"I's fine, Mr. Tobias. Must be something I ate on the trail."
Zek rode up on the marsh tacky stallion, which he had named Tiger, and Saul was in the saddle in front of him, his red hair tousled down his forehead. Zek said,
"Saul rode Tiger by himself down in the woods, and he did right well for the saddle not to have a horn. I've got to get him a western saddle so he can have something to hold on to.
You should have seen him go, Papa. He looked like a frog on a rabbit's back.
Glenda had come outside unnoticed. She said, I don't doubt that one bit, but you shouldn't turn a 5-year-old boy loose on a horse. First thing you know, you'll have him branding cows.
Next year, Zek said, dismounting and putting Sol on the ground. One more year and he can ride herd as good as anybody. We'll have us another drover.
I can do it now, Mama,
Sol said excitedly, scurrying to Glenda. I can ride as good as Papa.
Let's see how good you can wash your face and hands, Glenda said. Dinner's ready. All of you hurry on up before it gets cold.
They gathered at the long cypress table, where they still shared common meals, continuing the practice although the clan had grown larger. New planks were added to accommodate new arrivals. Frog popped a fried pork chop into his mouth and said,
Where you been to, Skillet? I figured you'd done wore poor old Pearly May out and gone after new wife. Where you got her hid, out in the woods? Pearly May gone kill you for sure.
There you go again, Frog, always teasing, Emma said. And don't talk with your mouth full. It doesn't set a good example for the young'uns.
Sorry about that, Miss Emma, Frog responded, but Skillet sure looks like he's been up to something.
Skillet suddenly pushed his plate away and started sobbing. All of the others were startled, and Frog said in a subdued voice,
What's the matter, Skillet? You ain't never took offense before when we jawed each other. I didn't mean nothing. I'm sorry.
It ain't that, Skillet said, his voice choked. I done a thing I ain't proud of.
What the devil is it? Tobias demanded. I've never seen you carry on so, Skillet. You done killed somebody?
No, sir, it's more than that. I've been with you more than 20 years, Mr. Tobias. You've been the onliest family I ever had. But it's time to go now. I got to leave.
You what? Tobias asked, totally baffled. How come you say that? Your family, Skillet. You can stay here as long as you want to.
I's getting old, Mr. Tobias, and I got 5 boys to look to. I got to see to them. I took some of that gold you've been giving me all these years and bought me some land south of Kissimmee. I got to start my own place so them boys can have something going for them after I's gone. I hope all of you ain't too mad at me. It would kill me if you is.
Nobody's mad at you, Skillet, Emma said, absorbing the meaning of the words.
You done the right thing. I'm proud of you.
Tears formed in Tobias's eyes. He was shocked by the news, but he understood. Skillet's desire for his own place was the same he had known all his life. He said,
Couldn't nobody be mad at you for what you done? You got a right to do what you want, same as anybody. But I'd like to help. You need more money?
No, sir, Mr. Tobias, I got enough. You done give me more than I ever dreamed of. I got plenty left after the land to build me a house and buy some cows and hogs and chickens and start a little farm, too. We'll make do fine, but I done something else you might want to shoot me for.
It would have to be powerful bad, Tobias said.
When I went to the land office, the man told me he couldn't record the deed just to Skillet, that I had to make up a last name if I didn't have one. I put it down as Skillet and Pearly May McIvy, and all the boys, too. I done took your name, Mr. Tobias. If you wants me to, I'll go back and change it to something else.
The shock and grief flushed out as Tobias said,
Hell, that's fine, Skillet. We're proud you took the name. You're welcome to it.
Don't swear in front of Sol, Emma admonished. It's not nice. But you know what you've done, Skillet? You've given me 6 grandsons instead of one. I'm right proud, too.
Skillet felt relief that he had revealed his decision without ill feelings. Had the response been otherwise, he might have backed away and stayed at the McIvy hammock. He said,
Lord, you show fine folks. I done got me my own place and a name, too. And it won't be like we's gone. It's close enough we can come back and visit whenever we want to. And if you needs me on a drive, I'll go.
And if you have need of us, we'll come, Tobias said. If anybody hassles you, they'll answer to me. McIvy's stick together, white or black. When you aim to set out?
Soon as we get our stuff loaded in the morning, Skillet responded.
Then we'll have a celebration tonight, Emma said. I'll cook the biggest meal you ever saw.
If she's gonna do that, you ought to come back and leave every week, Frog said.
Zek listened to it all, but said nothing. Too many memories cropping up at once. His voice choked as he said, Y'all excuse me a minute. I'm not sure I tied my horse.
He went behind the house and stood there alone, staring at the little cabin where Skillet and Pearly May lived, thinking of all the things Skillet had been an intimate part of, good and bad. Then he washed his face at the stoop and went back inside.
Pearly May stood by the loaded wagon, crying so hard she could only croak.
Mrs. Emma, Mrs. Glenda.
Both hugged her, and then Emma said, God bless you, Pearly May. We'll miss you.
Frog said to Skillet,
Nigger smell ain't so bad after all, Skillet. I got kind of used to it. I'll miss it for sure.
Skillet gave Frog a bear hug, pressing the breath from him.
Bless you, Frog, you old buzzard bait. And you take care of yourself. You getting old too, like me.
Ain't no use busting my ribs over it, Frog said. You need me to help out with something, you let me know.
Skillet then hugged Tobias and Zek, afraid to say more lest he would unload the wagon and stay. The boys clambered into the wagon bed as he helped Pearly May to the seat. He tried to speak again, but couldn't. Then he popped the whip, moved the oxen forward, and said,
I got to go now.
The others drifted away silently, as Tobias and Emma continued watching the wagon until it disappeared into the woods. Tobias said,
It's breaking up, Emma.
Yes, it is. But it has to, sooner or later. Nothing lasts forever. Everything ends.
Us too. Our time is coming. But it's sure been something while it lasted.
It rightly has.
She took his hand in hers, and they walked back toward the house, trudging slowly, as if tired. Tobias looking down at the deep ruts the loaded wagon cut in the sandy soil.
Chapter 30. 1892.
I wish I could have made Papa stay at home, Zek said, eating alone with Glenda. He'll soon be 60 years old, and he's too sick to be out here on the prairie.
The spells are coming more often, Glenda said, but you can't tie him up with ropes and leave him behind.
I will next time if I have to. I'd rather tie him up than see him die out here in a cypress stand.
Does there really have to be a next time?
Glenda asked seriously. Won't the orange trees make enough money without us driving cows all over the countryside to Punta Raza?
I suppose so, but the whole thing of shipping from Punta Raza is going to be settled someday. There's trouble brewing in Cuba, and sooner or later there'll be a war down there. When it happens, there won't be any more Cuban market. Someday all the cows will be shipped up north on the railroad.
That would surely be better than this, Glenda said. I hope it happens soon. And we've got enough land of our own now to fatten cattle for market. We don't have to roam around out here looking for grass. If you would just go ahead and fence our land, we could stay at home until shipping time.
I'm going to do that, but it'll sure cause trouble with that Alistair family up north of us. Every time I go up that way, they're on our land. I've warned them, but they don't pay any more attention to me than they would a jaybird. They're as stubborn as Papa about open range.
Saul came galloping in on Tiger and was followed by a new man Zek hired named Lester. He was in his early 40s and a typical cracker drover, rail thin, beard covered and somber, like Frog. But also like Frog, inside he was both gentle and tough when he had to be.
Saul was stamped from his father's mold, except for the red hair. He was already taller than most boys at age 9, broad-shouldered and lanky. He said, Is Grampy feeling better?
I suppose, Glenda responded. We'll be moving on soon, so you and Lester better eat now.
I'll see to Grampy first,
Saul said, bounding off toward the wagon.
Tobias was sitting beneath the shade of a palmetto, mopping his forehead with a damp cloth. His hair and beard were now completely gray, his body even leaner than ever.
Saul threw his arms around him and said, How you feeling, Grampy? You missed a good one this morning. We saw a bear over by the edge of the woods, and when I charged toward him with Tiger, he ran away.
I've seen enough bears already, Tobias said, but you best be careful. There was a time
when a bear would snatch you off that horse and eat you, and then eat the horse for good measure.
Here, swallow this, Emma commanded, shoving quinine into Tobias's mouth. Tobias grimaced. Then he said to Saul,
Boy, don't ever let yourself get into the mess of having a woman around always shoveling crap into you. It ain't worth it.
Hush up and go eat, Emma snapped. You get more cantankerous every day. You're worse than an old billy goat. You need food for strength.
See what I mean? Tobias said, smiling. She's like a crow sitting in a tree, squawking at everything that passes.
You can ride in the wagon with Granny if you want to, Saul said. Me and Papa and Lester can handle the cows. I could do it by myself if they'd let me.
I suppose you could, Tobias said, getting up. You're a McIvey through and through for sure. And I might just ride with Granny for a day or two and let you prove yourself.
That's the only thing you've said that makes sense, Emma said. You don't need to be out there in the sun on a horse. Them cows can chomp grass without you staring at every bite they take.
We'll do it, Saul said enthusiastically. We'll handle the cows while you rest up some, but come on now, Grampy, and let's eat. I'm about to starve.
Tobias took the boy's hand and felt himself tugged hurriedly toward the cooking pot. Emma smiled at both of them as she followed. The herd grazed in a northwesterly direction. 1,100 cows, mostly homegrown rather than popped wild out of swamps. By not driving to market each year, the calves were given time to grow on land closer to home. Some were still rounded up wild, but not so many as in days past. One morning they could see the railroad in the distance as the sun reflected off shiny steel rails. It was the new line into Tampa. Zek and Frog had come upon a section of it under construction while scouting grazing land, and the foreman contracted with them for delivery of 2 dressed steers each day for $40 per steer. They followed the workers for over a month, killing and dressing beef at the corral and taking it to the site in the wagon. When the construction crew moved too far away for the dressed meat to be transported safely in the heat, they followed the crew for 2 more weeks, driving cows with them and butchering on the spot. Then they abandoned the project and returned home. When the lead steer reached the rails, they could see smoke boiling up on the horizon, painting a black streak in the sky. Soon afterwards, a tooting sound broke the silence of the prairie. The cows poured halfway across the rails and stopped, oblivious to the engine puffing toward them. Zek and Frog popped their whips frantically, trying to move the balking herd. Tobias jumped from the wagon and watched as the train came closer without slowing. And then he shouted, "That damn fool is going to plow right into him!" Zek and Frog wheeled their horses and got out of the way as the engine smashed into the herd, its iron cowcatcher scooping up 3 cows, crushing and killing them instantly. The train then came to a stop 100 yards down the rails. Zek looked at the mangled bodies. Then he and Frog rode quickly to the idling engine, its stack belching soot over the grass. Zek shouted,
"What the hell you mean, fella? Can't you see a herd of cows a mile away? If you'd stopped that damn thing, we'd have got them out of the way."
The engineer leaned out the window and shouted back,
"If you hadn't had them friggin' yellow hammers on company property, it wouldn't have happened anyway. You're going to make us late."
"That's no excuse for what you done," Zek said angrily. "The railroad's got no right to keep us from passing. You know that as well as I do. You could have stopped for a few minutes. Who's going to pay us for the cows you killed?"
"File a claim with the headquarters office in Tampa," the engineer said. "But don't try to charge us $100 each for buzzard bait worth 15. We won't stand for it no more. I ain't never seen so many $100 cows till we hit some flea-bit varmint out here on the prairie. Then all of a sudden it's worth its weight in gold. Who the hell you crackers take us for anyway, a bunch of fools?"
None of them noticed Tobias as he walked on the side of the engine, carrying the shotgun. He aimed at the boiler and pulled both triggers, blowing an 8-inch hole in the steel plate. Steam shot out and hissed loudly like angry rattlesnakes, spewing a white cloud over the engine. The engineer and the fireman hit the deck as Zek and Frog's horses bolted away. Tobias lowered the shotgun and walked calmly back to the wagon. The engineer finally peeked out the window and said,
"What the hell?"
Zek brought the bucking horse under control and returned to the edge of the billowing steam cloud. The engineer jumped from the cabin and came to him.
"Do you know what the old fool has done?
he shouted. "It'll take us a half day to patch the boiler and get up steam again. Who's going to pay for this?"
"We'll swap out," Zek said, trying hard to be serious. "We'll trade you our dead cows for your hole. That ought to about even things up. We'll see you, and good luck with the patching."
As Zek and Frog rode off, the engineer shouted after them,
"Damn you, idiots, cracker jackasses!"
Zek made no comment to Tobias as they moved the herd on across the tracks and to the west. Frog rode up to him and said,
"The old man's still got fire in his guts, ain't he?"
"Sure seems that way," Zek said. "That breech loader has killed everything but a train engine, and now it's done that, too." After crossing the railroad, they turned due north and grazed unmolested for a week. Then one morning, another herd was spotted on the horizon. Wishing no confrontation, Zek ordered them to move south again. They recrossed the rail line without incident and drifted to the southwest. At noon one day a week later, they were once again approached by armed riders. Off to the right of the herd, no more than 2 miles away, Zek could see men digging frantically with both machines and shovels, cutting wide gashes in the earth. As soon as the riders reached him, he said, "What's happening over there? Looks like the biggest fish bait digging contest I ever seen. Must be some kind of worms them fellows are after."
"'Tain't worms," one man said. "It's phosphate. You'll have to turn away. There's no way you can get them cows through here, and it's the same. Slam over to the coast and for 50 miles south. You best go east and around."
"Appears to me they're just digging up dirt," Zek said, puzzled. "How'll they ever get all them holes filled back up?"
"They won't. As I said, it's phosphate. Folks has gone plumb wild over it. As bad as the 49 gold rush. Speculators are jumping around like rabbits, buying land and filing claims and jumping claims and shooting at each other, raising pure hell like you never seen. If I were you, I'd cut a wide path away from here before some fool cracks down at you from behind a bush. The mine over yonder belongs to a company out of Chicago, and they aim to fence the whole area. We got orders to turn everybody away."
Zek felt no anger, as he had when they were denied entrance to the distant land. He said resignedly,
"I guess you're just doing your job. We'll cut east and find another way to Punta Rasa, but it sure seems the whole prairie is going to hell in a basket. I don't know what use they'll ever make of them big holes once they're done with the mining. Beats me, but I think nobody gives a damn. I'm paid to ride guard, and that's all. I ain't in the whole business. But if I were you, mister, I wouldn't come this way again. We done had 2 gun battles this week over that stuff they're digging up, and there's 4 men dead cause of it. You best stay away."
"I'll do that," Zek said, "and I thank you for the advice." They turned the herd eastward for several days, and then south again, finding land that seemed like times gone by, endless stretches of palmetto prairie and scrub pine shared only with herds of deer and flights of birds. One night, as Zek listened apprehensively to the lonesome cry of a wolf, realizing it was a harmless lone voice and not a pack, he wondered what the future held for old adversaries like wolves and bears, and for all the other creatures that depended on the land for survival. He remembered that night years ago, when he had witnessed the ritual of animals peacefully sharing the life-giving water, some inborn instinct telling them they must share and conserve to survive. Perhaps animals are smarter than men, he thought, taking only what they need to live today, leaving something for tomorrow. Even the hated wolf kills only for food and only for immediate need. Maybe it is man who will eventually perish as he destroys the land and all that it offers, taking the animals down with him. As he thought of these things and the unknown future, he realized one thing was certain. If the wilderness shrinks, pushing more and more men together, there will be explosions without end. Some will yield, but others won't, and someone will be hurt. It will never be like the animals sharing water.
Chapter 31. After they had bought cows from several small ranchers, the herd numbered 2,000 when they reached Punta Rasa at the end of the summer. The market price had gone up to $20 per head, and Zek collected $40,000 in gold doubloons. Tobias was not present when the accounting was made. After loading the gold on the wagon, Zek went into the office of Jacob Summerlin, the present owner of the Punta Rasa shipping facility. He said to him, "I'm interested in buying some land south of Okeechobee. Is there a land office down there anywhere?"
"There's a small trading post on the southwest shore," Summerlin replied. "Mostly does business in gator hides and egret plumes, but the man who owns it is a land agent. What you gonna do, go in the bullfrog and wildcat business? I don't know why anybody would want a piece of that place."
"Oh, I don't know, Mr. Summerlin. I went through there once a long time ago, and just thought I'd like to have some of it."
"I imagine you can get all you want. Most folks don't even know where it is, but there's beginning to be activity over that way. There's some commercial fish houses dealing in catfish, but they're mostly on the north shore and the east side. I don't know of a thing to the south."
"Last time I went there from Punta Rasa, we followed the river to the lake and then turned south. It seems that's pretty far out of the way if I'm heading straight for the south shore. Is there a better way to get there?"
"Well, if you go straight east from here, you'll run into a place called the Devil's Gardens. If you go in there, you're liable not to come out again. Some folks claim it's haunted. Past that is another swamp just about as bad. If you swing down south from here, don't go too far in that direction. That's outlaw country. I wouldn't go in there with nothing less than General Grant's army. Best thing to do is follow the river again for about 30 miles, and then turn southeast. If you ride steady, you can make it in a day, more or less, depending on how good your horse is."
"Thanks for the information," Zek said. "I'll see you next drive we make." As he walked away, Summerlin shouted after him,
"Hey, McIvey, don't let nobody down there sell you a gator farm."
Emma suggested to Zek it would be wise to let Tobias rest at the cabin for a week before setting out on the return trip, and it was during this idle time Zek contemplated making the trip to Okeechobee. When he arrived at the cabin, he called Glenda aside to discuss what he intended to do. He said to her, "If we stay here for a week, I'll have nothing to do but sit, so I thought I'd ride over to Okeechobee and see about buying some land. Mr. Summerlin told me where to go. Would you mind being here without me?"
"No, I don't mind at all. We'll be fine. How much land are you thinking of buying?"
"I don't know. I'll stuff both saddlebags with doubloons and buy whatever I can get with it. We may never need land down there, but again, we might. And I'd rather have the land than more gold sitting in trunks back at the house. We'll pretty soon have to start storing it in the barn."
"How long do you think you'll be gone?"
"I'm sure I can make it there and back before we start home. I'll leave at dawn tomorrow and take Tiger. He'll be faster on a trip like this than the roan. Whatever time it takes, I'll be back as soon as I can."
"Don't kill yourself or the horse by hurrying.
There's no need of that. It's good for Tobias to rest for as long as we can keep him here.
I sure hope you can talk him out of making any more of these trips."
Zek cantered the marsh tacky for 2 hours at a time and rested him when they encountered thick woods, then cantered again. Moving steadily without stopping to eat, he covered the 60 miles to the lake shore and found the trading post before sundown. The owner was a relatively young man of 40, dressed in blue overalls and brogan shoes. He seemed mildly surprised when Zek entered the store.
"Kind of late to be pushing a horse way out here," he said. "I don't see many riders near to sundown. Where you coming in from?"
"Punta Rasa. I've been riding steady all day. You got some cheese?"
"Nope, sure don't. It's too hot here to keep cheese. I tried it once, and it spoiled before I could sell it. A whole 50-pound block. Turned plum green. I gave it to some Indians, and they ate it anyway. Last I seen of them, they was down by the lake puking to beat all hell. Sounded worse than a bunch of whooping cranes trying to mate. Next time I seen one of them, he told me he couldn't shit for a month. Turned plum green, too. You ever seen a green Indian?"
"You didn't ride slam over here from Punta Rasa for cheese, did you?" Zek ignored the question. "What have you got to eat? I didn't have room in my saddlebags to bring food."
"Tin beef? How many you want?"
2 cans will do for now." He took the meat from a shelf, handed it to Zek, and said,
"Where you headed? You sure don't smell like a hide trader. If the wind's blowing this way, I know when they're coming, when they're still 10 miles away."
"Right here. I'm interested in buying land and was told you're an agent."
"Yeah, that's right, I am. But it's just a sideline. My main business is trading. If I had to depend on the commission I get for handling land sales in these parts, I'd have starved to death a long time ago.
What keeps me in this hell hole is gator hides and egret plumes. Them damn feathers is bringing $2 each now. Ain't that something? $2 for something grown out of a bird's rear. What you interested in?
Land to the south of the lake.
How much you got in mind? It comes in 80-acre sections. You want a whole section?
How much is it an acre?
Going price right now is 15 cents. But as I say, you can't buy no less than 80 acres. Anything less than